Hello and welcome to another episode of Diabetes Dialogue, Technology, Therapeutics, and Real World Perspectives. My name is Diana Isaacs. I am joined with my co-host, Natalie Bellini, and we have a very exciting episode from ADA Psy Sessions in Chicago and a very special guest with us. We have Dr. John Hughes, and we are going to talk today all about the Catalyst trial. So thank you so much for joining us. And then for our listeners and viewers, if you don't mind just introducing yourself and giving us a little bit of your background.
Sure. My name is John Buse. I'm a professor at the University of North Carolina School of Medicine in Chapel Hill. I am a diabetes clinician and diabetes clinical trialist. And I have been doing these kinds of trials for about 30 years. And this is about the most exciting thing I've ever done.
I will not respond
30
here.
Years.
Yeah. So talk to us. Let's dive right in. Talk to us about Catalyst more.
Yeah. So the phase one, the Catalyst trial was set to examine what was the role of hypercortisolism in difficult-to-control type 2 diabetes. And it was divided into two parts. In phase one, we just wanted to know the prevalence, how common was hypercortisolism. And in type 2, we wanted to provide a proof of concept that if you knew that someone had hypercortisolism in the setting of type 2 diabetes, and then you used a cortisol-directed therapy, would it improve the things that we care about in diabetes? So part one, prevalence. So we define difficult to control type 2 diabetes in four ways. Three or more, well, A1C between 7.5 and 11.5. And you could be that with three or more glucose lowering medications, or two glucose lowering medications where one was insulin, or two glucose lowering medications with a complication, microvascular or cardiovascular complication, or two glucose lowering medications and at least two blood pressure medications. So we had four flavors, and then we recruited a bit over 1,000, 1,057 people, and we did a single overnight dexamethasone suppression test. So the patient takes 1 milligram of dexamethasone 11 p.m. They come in to have a blood test for cortisol and dexamethasone at 8 a.m. the next day. The cortisol level cut point that we used was greater than 1.8, would indicate hypercortisolism. The dexamethasone level is to ensure that they took the tablet and that it was absorbed, and the cut point that we used was greater than 140. And of that 1,057 patients, there were 23.8%. So nearly one in four patients had evidence of hypercortisolism. So that was all published in the May, it was published in May online in Diabetes Care, but will come out in print relatively soon.
And that all by itself. So if you think back before this whole, the first part of the trial started, and I love to talk about this because what would have been your guess as to the rate of hypercortisolism in people with what we call difficult to control A1C of 7.5? Sometimes, I mean, is that difficult to control? But it's the number of meds, it's the blood pressure on top of it, it's the complication. But I don't think any one of us thought it was even close to that.
Yeah, so among the investigators, there was a little poll at the beginning, and I think there was one person who said 8%. Most people guessed 1, 2,
No
3%.
way.
Right. But the truth of the matter is, we should have known better. And the reason we didn't is the previous publications that have looked at this have looked in Brazil, in Italy. They were smaller in size. They were a little bit different in how they defined hypercortisolism. And they almost always had as their primary endpoint hypercortisolism defined in a more complicated way, so that you had to have a dexamethasone suppression test and a late night salivary cortisol. And so their bottom line was that it was 2 or 3%. But when you use our definition, it was 24%. But that gets us to the issue. Well, there's another cool thing about this, and that is that there are certain populations who had even higher risks. So if you look at people that were on three or more blood pressure medicines and had difficult to control type 2 diabetes, it was, I think it was 36.6%. If you looked at people with clinical cardiovascular disease, heart attacks, strokes, heart failure, AFib, it was about 50% higher risk than the others. The people on the most powerful glucose-lowering agents, tirzepatide or high doses of GLP-1 receptor agonists or SGLT2 inhibitors, they were at higher risk as well. So basically, you know, the interesting thing is when we talk about, when endocrinologists talk about hypercortisolism, they have a picture in their mind of a round-faced person, ruddy-looking with the dorso-cervical fat pad, purple stria, massive central obesity. These people had no phenotype. You could not, I mean, both of you could have hypercortisolism in the CATALYST study. The phenotype was people with sort of multimorbidity. You know, they tended to have more than just type 2 diabetes. They had dyslipidemia. They had anxiety or depression. They had pain. So a lot of conditions, a lot of complaints, and a lot of medications.
And that's so interesting because when we think about that, you're exactly right. Think about, you close your eyes and think about the picture in your textbook. That person has had hypercortisolism. They've had Cushing's for years and years and years, and it's been untreated. And we can't wait that long because those people suffer and die at a higher rate at younger years of cardiovascular disease.
The other thing is those people generally had pituitary-dependent Cushing's disease, and so their cortisol levels were actually higher.
Right.
So these patients have generally adrenal-based disease. And to move to the second part of the study was to develop the proof of concept that a cortisol-directed therapy would improve what we care about in diabetes. We wanted to do a relatively short study. So, you know, the things that we could care about in 6 months were hemoglobin A1C and weight and those sorts of issues. The possibility that it would reduce the risk of heart disease and kidney complications is real, but we're going to need a much larger, much longer study. So in part two, the first thing is we wanted patients that had so-called ACTH-independent hypercortisolism, so this adrenal-based disease. The further evaluation beyond the screening test in part one was that they had to have an ACTH, a morning ACTH, and a morning DHEA sulfate. And if those were at the lower limits of normal, that indicates that it's ACTH-independent disease. Everybody had an adrenal CT scan, it was about a third of people had an adrenal abnormality. 25% had a single adenoma, and that theoretically could have been surgically managed or perhaps will be surgically managed, but we randomized them 2-1 to mifepristone, which is a cortisol receptor antagonist, or placebo, and then followed them for 24 weeks. And what we found was the mifepristone-treated patients started with an A1C of 8.6, and they got down to about 7.1, so a 1.5% reduction in hemoglobin A1C. The placebo-treated patients started a little bit lower, I think it was 8.3, and they had a 0.15 reduction, so
wow,
a tenth as much reduction in A1C. The difference at the end of the trial in the change in hemoglobin A1C was around 1.3%. So a really clinically meaningful, you know, big change in hemoglobin A1C. On average, people lost 5 kilograms of additional weight, which was about 4% of their initial body weight. And you know, those were the main efficacy endpoints. With regards to adverse events, the major issues were, you know, as would be expected. The truth of the matter is the people that were treating patients in this trial did not have a lot of experience using mifepristone that's classically been used for Cushing's disease. So there was about 40% or so of the patients in the trial did not complete mifepristone therapy. The proportion of patients that completed with placebo was substantially higher. Most of the withdrawals related to adverse events were related to the so-called glucocorticoid withdrawal syndrome. So whether you take your adrenal out for hypercortisolism or your pituitary out for hypercortisolism, or you take one of these cortisol-directed therapies, many patients have this sense of fatigue, nausea, sometimes vomiting, headache, just
don't. Withdrawal is, it can be significant.
They just do not feel well. And we probably weren't quite as expert in helping people work through that as we could have been, and we should have done a better job. It's harder to do in a placebo-controlled trial because you don't know who's getting the drug. And then there were patients with hypokalemia as well. And again, in a placebo-controlled trial, harder to do the proactive things. But, you know, in clinical practice, you would probably start patients on
Right.
Exactly. You'd start patients on spironolactone proactively as you prescribe them mifepristone.
And I think that is a big part of it, right? The thing is that when you take out an, you know, when you do an adrenalectomy and you're just, here we go, we're going to take this out, we're going to fix it. Those people have pretty significant side effects. But when we're giving a medication, what we've learned pretty quickly is there is no ramp up that you have to follow. So what we're doing is we're doing this slow as we can. Right. You know, with older patients, we're even slowing it down even more and saying that you won't feel worse before you feel better. There's, I think, a better education around the medication, but also we can slow it down because we're not in a treat demanding way in a study. But the end result is you're going to not just reduce their A1C, but improve their outcomes, hopefully, right? And in the end, they will feel better. That's just a little bit of a journey to get there.
Yeah, and the other thing is the number that I gave, with the 1.5% reduction in A1C, that even might be an underestimate of the true power of the drug for two reasons. One, you know, 40% of patients didn't complete the trial. And analysis was done on an intent to treat basis. When we looked at analyses that were based on completers or people, you know, where we only used A1Cs in people that were on the assigned therapy, the A1C reduction was higher. And the majority of patients treated with mifepristone had to withdraw, either reduce the dose or eliminate drugs, particularly insulin, because of concerns over hyperglycemia. Now, we were all diabetes experts, and so there was no severe hyperglycemia. We managed the insulin part of it really well, but we had less experience in using mifepristone, which is a drug that's a little bit tricky to use.
So that's interesting. So regarding other medication changes, it sounds like the group with the mifepristone actually had less medication.
Exactly.
Right.
And versus the control group, were medications increased? Were they?
Well, there were some that increased and some that decreased, but I don't remember the numbers exactly, but let's say 60 or 70% of patients had some reduction in their medications on mifepristone. It was, 15 or 20%.
That makes it even more impressive.
Right. No, that's what I mean. And then with regards to the weight, we only went out to 26 weeks. There was a recommended starting with 300 milligrams and as tolerated go to 600 milligrams and if needed go to 900 milligrams. And so we didn't have a lot of time to see what the full effect of the full dose was. So the weight at 24 months was less than at 24 weeks was less than the weight at 12 weeks, which was less than the weight at baseline. So we really don't know how far that might go. Now, another really weird thing is if you asked 100 clinicians and even 100 diabetologists, if you were going to find people with hypercortisolism, what do you think the feature that would really be the dead bang giveaway? My guess is most of them would say obesity, or I certainly would have guessed that would be it.
Right.
It turns out that the people with a BMI less than 30 were at higher risk of hypercortisolism. So these people did not start out as particularly obese as a population. And that's even true when you look at the Cushing's disease. So Mini-G, the first case report, when if you remember that picture, pretty massive central,
right,
panis, but her BMI was 24. So they're sort of
all here.
Right. They're
she gained her weight.
Puffy people. They look puffy all over, but it's really very central fat distribution.
So I just because we're at the American Diabetes Association, I want to go back to that insulin dosing. So what you did was took out all mealtime insulin, correct? So how did you decide who was going to, what would you do as a clinician now, knowing what you knew now about the trial?
Right.
I'm starting somebody, they're on basal bolus, and maybe even a GLP-1 in the background. We would never stop a GLP-1.
Right, that would be the last drug you stop.
Exactly, right? And it never,
Now, the one reason you might stop the GLP-1, you know, there were people who stopped the GLP-1s. And the reason why you might is if a person was really bothered with nausea and just, you know, lost their appetite and blah, 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 blah. I suspect that was the situation. With the insulin, you know, as usual, you know, what you would normally, I mean, the way I tend to handle it with these things where, you know, more commonly in the past, it's been adding GLP-1 receptor agonist therapy to people on multiple daily injections. You know, there I might say, well, just cut your meal-associated insulin in half and let's see, you know, let's see what happens. So people's A1C goes up a little bit for a little while, and then as the drug cut kicks in, it comes down. In a placebo-controlled trial, you don't know if they're on placebo, so you can't do that up front. If someone's, you know, these people had an A1C on average of 8.5, so you can't just add the drug and say, look, if you start seeing any blood sugars in the low hundreds, then cut the mealtime insulin in half. You see blood sugars that are, you know, around 100 in the morning, you know, cut your basal insulin by 25%. So I tend to make big cuts in insulin with the idea that, you know, we can always go back up on the dose of
better, right? That is, you know, if you, and they're already going through the cortisol withdrawal,
right?
So they already don't feel good. Now you've made them have some, you know, could be potentially significant hypoglycemia. Now they don't ever speak to you again. So we really want to keep them safe first. And that's what I found too, is if we cut that mealtime insulin back and give them some time and say, you may run higher before you come down, seems to be the safest way to do this.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, with regards to the insulin. And then, you know, the other thing that came up, there weren't people who got, you know, really hypertensive. There was a small increase in blood pressure in the mifepristone arm. And a small decrease in the placebo arm, and there is this potential mechanism by which if you block cortisol action and you continue to have this driver for cortisol overproduction, that you can have more other sort of cortisol metabolites that can have effects on the aldosterone system. And so that's another part of the rationale for starting spironolactone proactively. But, you know, people, it's not like people developed elevated blood pressures that require, you know, any kind of intervention. But that's something that needs to be monitored when you're using mifepristone.
Can you talk a little bit more about the discontinuation rates? So were there higher discontinuation rates in the mifepristone group compared to placebo?
Yeah. And that, to me, that was the real readout that, you know, this mifepristone drug is challenging to use. When I talk to colleagues that have a lot of experience using it, they say they don't really have that problem. And I think it's because, A, they don't have to deal with the issue that you don't really know if the patient's on the drug or placebo. It's the first thing. This drug has a pretty long half-life, so it takes a while for it to kick in. And then the second thing is, with more experience, I think they just do a better job of talking people through the glucocorticoid withdrawal syndrome. They do a better job of pre-treating people with spironolactone and getting the drugs up to 100 milligrams twice a day, as opposed to the baby doses that diabetes doctors usually use, like 25 milligrams twice a day. But the more experienced clinicians feel like it's a drug that they feel comfortable using, it is tricky. And so I think for a primary care doctor, you know, working with someone who has experience in doing cortisol-directed therapies would be useful, or certainly, you know, reading the publications on mifepristone therapy, that there's some nice ones that the references are in the papers. Oh, and this treatment phase will be published online in diabetes care tomorrow.
Yes.
Amazing. That'll be Monday.
And that reference on how to use mifepristone is in there.
Oh, that's awesome. And is this therapy, is it intended for people to use it long term, or would the intention be that some may go on to have surgery?
Well, it's only a third had any adrenal abnormality, and the ones, the pictures that look like, yeah, that might be a surgical case, that's a quarter. So it's not everybody's going to be able to do that. One notion that's been discussed is, it's nobody wants to have their adrenal taken out. It's a pretty big operation. And so some people might decide to go the mifepristone route with the idea that they would see if it helped them with their diabetes control. It might reduce their surgical risk because there are concerns about post-operative wound infections and DVTs in people with high A1Cs. And so you can sort of medically manage them in preparation for surgery. And then, if they do really well, they could decide to continue with the drug, or they could decide, well, this is sort of proof of concept. Let's get the adrenal out. I don't want to take this drug the rest of my life. There are people with Cushing syndrome who have taken this drug for years. I can't tell you the details, but that's what I've been told by the people who are experienced in this field.
And then I'm curious, are there other, with all the side effects, potential side effects of this agent, are there other drugs that may, be tried, or maybe other things in the pipeline to address?
Yeah, so the company that sponsored this trial, Forcept, that markets mifepristone, has a follow-on agent with a much cleaner profile in the publications to date, under review by the FDA. And so with luck, we might have another agent in the next year that does seem to be relatively easy to use. Now, we won't have proof that it would work in this situation, but we'll have a pretty good idea. I mean, there are a number of other drugs available in the sort of cortisol-directed therapy space where the companies have gotten really interested in this topic now, because historically, Cushing syndrome has been considered a rare disease. So you have something that was thought to be a rare disease that probably, hypercortisolism probably affects something like 10% of all the people in the United States with diabetes, if the numbers translate, from the clinical trial. So we're talking more than 1 million people in the United States alone. So you go from rare disease to pretty common. But in any case, those companies are thinking about it as well. In general, and I'm not a Cushing's expert, I'm a diabetes guy. But from talking to the Cushing's experts, those drugs are not super easy to use either.
Okay.
Again, my advice would be primary care doctors should be screening for hypercortisolism in their patients with difficult to control diabetes. However you define it, sort of people with just a long problem list or lots of complaints or not doing very well with their blood pressure or cholesterol. Blood pressure or diabetes, or they're on fibrates for hypertriglyceridemia as well. So that sort of complex patient with type 2 diabetes, they should be screening. If they find a positive screening test, don't go running down those rabbit holes about all the other tests you can do for Cushing's disease. Find somebody who, who's facile with using this class of medications to help you work out what's the minimum set of diagnostic tests you need to do and try.
As you need to, right.
And
yep.
A therapeutic trial to see if it makes all the difference. So there was a patient that didn't qualify for the study because her A1C was 7.3, but I had known her 20 years before. She was a, charming, lovely, chill person. She came back after 20 years and her A1C was, she had never had diabetes when I knew her before. She had anxiety and depression and pain and, just all kinds of stuff going on. She was kind of a mess. So we did the tests, treated her with mifepristone, and she's lost 30 pounds, stopped insulin, A1C is like 5.5. And all that baggage, I mean, she's back to her old lovely persona.
That just makes me smile, right? Yeah. Like this is, and this is a woman who's doing everything everyone told her to do, right? Right. Those are the tough ones where, you know, some people, they don't fill their drugs on time. They, you know, they, this is not that. These are people who have done all of this time and time again, and they still aren't at where they still feel, they don't feel well. Their blood pressures are always off there, you know, and these are the people we should be thinking about differently, yeah. Right?
And I'm glad you mentioned that. So for her and many people in the study, this was like such a relief. Oh my God, you know, my family has thought that I was just not doing what I'm supposed to do. I just knew that you, the doctor, thought that I wasn't doing, you know, I was trying real hard. I'm so glad to know that I, you know, that I have an excuse. It wasn't. It was, and then for me with that particular patient, you know, I always felt bad that she was so overwrought and I didn't seem to be able to fix her. And so for me, it was a great relief that my, you know, that my skills as a diagnostician and treating physician, you know, that I was able to help somebody that I wasn't able to help and just felt bad for not being able to help. You know, you can't fix everyone, but now you can fix more people than you thought you could.
So based on all of this, how do you think the ADA standards of care should perhaps change?
That's a great question. And so what I would, I mean, I'm not the boss anymore. I used to be. But I think there should be a strong recommendation about screening for hypercortisolism with sort of broad language about the kinds of things that were associated with high risk for hypercortisolism in the Catalyst study. And I don't think they should say, and if you have hypercortisolism, you should be treated with mifepristone. I think they should say, you should consider using cortisol-directed therapies and reference the Catalyst study. And this is early days. And that said, I think that many people will be treated with mifepristone and cortisol-directed therapies because the results of the Catalyst study are so spectacular, despite the fact that only about 60% of people were able to finish the trial. And, you know, we got an A1C reduction of 1.5%, despite the fact that most people reduced their dose of highly effective medicines like insulin.
Wow, that's amazing. Well, thank you so much for joining us. This has been incredible. And I want to thank everyone for tuning in. And that concludes this episode of Diabetes Dialogue, Technology, Therapeutics, and Real World Perspectives.